Hello and welcome to the Multiverse of Marketing. I am your host, Crash and Burn, and with me as always is J.R. Sweeney.
Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too bad. I mean, like, if you got to watch the world burn, at least from a moderate distance away, it's not so bad. But at least, you know, I got to really entertain myself with some fun, silly shit. This has been, like, usually you read one comic for this, but we got 7 comics and a movie out of this one.
Yeah. So we're talking about The Meteor Man, which is a 1993 Robert Townsend superhero movie.
Yeah.
Did not do well.
No.
So here's the thing. It's not great. In as much as, leaving aside certain issues, which I'll get to.
We'll get to those.
It is a little like it's a bit corny as fuck.
I mean, like, here's the thing, and I think his intention with it. So for those who don't know Robert Townsend, he tends to be kind of like really, really sharp wit, really kind of like black community, like community level kind of content. His stuff typically talks about that, the undercurrent of like what black people have to typically go through.
Hollywood Shuffle is phenomenal.
Oh my God. So amazing. Yeah.
Hollywood Shuffle.
Yeah.
This has a phenomenal cast.
An incredible cast. Let me just pull up the cast list for one moment, because this is ridiculous with like one exception, which again, we will get to. So starring Robert Townsend, you know, because if you're writing and directing a film, why not star in it as well? Marla Gibbs, Eddie Griffin, Robert Guillaume, Guillaume, I've been saying that wrong for years.
Yeah, it's Guillaume.
Oh, delightful. James Earl Jones with, like, this has overtaken my favorite James Earl Jones performance, replacing his incredible turn in Conan the Barbarian. This is something to be seen.
Yes.
Another bad creation, as in, yes, the early 90s hip hop, like, children's group, another bad creation.
Yeah.
Stephanie E. Williams, Roy Fagan, Frank Gorshin.
Yep.
But Luther Vandross, Sinbad for like 2 minutes. And the character is just like an inexplicable, like, cameo stereotype appearance. And it's like, oh, okay. Bye, Sinbad. See you later.
Well, I like his because his character is black dude who gets really into black liberation for the women.
Yeah, and like that's a great like joke skewing, you know, like a character, a stereotype within the community, and like you've seen it throughout a lot of like, you know, black art. But he's like, he's there and then he's gone. And it's like, does he ever come back? Whatever. It's for like, you know, it probably would have made more sense if it wasn't Sinbad. If the actor who portrayed it didn't go on to become like so recognizable that it's like, no, Sinbad was just here. Where'd Sinbad go?
Well, I think one of the big issues is the whole Stacy subplot, because he is Robert Townsend's ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend. The whole Stacy thing goes nowhere.
Yeah, and apparently it was going to be included, and it just got cut for, like, timing and pacing and stuff. And it does, unfortunately, rob us of more of that character, but as well, like, sense to his introduction. Because he's supposed to kind of be, like, a foil to Robert Townsend's character. And he just vanishes.
Yeah.
Moving on, Naughty by Nature play the Bloods. Cypress Hill plays the Crips, Big Daddy Kane, Don Cheadle, Nancy Wilson, Tommy Tiny Lister, Jennifer Lewis, Wallace Shawn, John Witherspoon, and Chris Tucker phenomenal. Off screen. And yeah, as ever, John Witherspoon is just beautiful. My favorite moments in Boondocks is when they realize that no one gives a shit about Huey or Riley, and it just became the John Witherspoon cartoon hour.
Right. That was Chris Tucker, though, because I missed him in the cast list, but I heard his voice and I'm like, that's fucking Chris Tucker.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that is Chris Tucker. I believe he is uncredited. Yeah, he's uncredited and he doesn't appear, but you cannot miss that voice.
Right.
Like, that's fucking Chris Tucker. Some people in this movie are in this movie because they haven't yet made it big. Some people are in this movie because they did make it big and they're, like, recognizable, you know, stars.
It's a stacked cast.
Oh my God. It's insane. And he made this film essentially by the power of, I feel like it, and no one told me no. So there's practically nothing out there in terms of, like, movie trivia about this. Like, it's very difficult to find any good details about the production or anything. Until you stop looking in movie world and you move over into, like, black culture media. And on Shondaland.com, I found a wonderful interview from, I want to say, 5 years ago, where he talked about this movie finally. And we get an idea of how this insane film, which is, I believe, characters, story, plot, original idea, all that is separate. And original to Townsend and all of his work. This is effectively, in many regards, Richard Donner's Superman. And I don't mean that as in it's copying it. I mean that as in the goofiness, the approach, the silly childishness. It all makes sense if you consider this to be essentially like the black community's Richard Donner's Superman.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Because from what he said in the interview, he was inspired to make this movie for one really basic reason. He was visiting one of his nephews. His nephew was like 4 or 5 or something. And it was around Halloween. And he asked, what are you going to dress up as? Are you going to dress up as Spider-Man, Batman, Superman? And his nephew said no, because they're all white. And you know, he, of course, went like hell. So he immediately started working on an idea of, like, okay, the first black superhero movie. Like, obviously, there have been black superheroes on TV and in the Super Friends in the form of Black Lightning. And there had been black superheroes in comic books, but there had not been a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he himself created from scratch not only the first black superhero, Meteor Man, whose powers are whatever they need to be,
it's a very Silver Age Superman, wherein it's just kind of like there's not really anything he can't do. He's able to pick up whatever's in a book by osmosis for 30 seconds. He's able to talk to dogs. He has heat vision, he has super speed, he has flight, invulnerability, super strength, super hearing, I think, just telekinesis, and just it's really just, you know, whatever we think would be kind of cool in the moment.
It's such Silver Age, excuse me, it's such Silver Age storytelling. And coming, was it 4 years after Batman 89, definitely not what people wanted. But like, if this had come in the early 80s, on the heels of Richard Donner's Superman, I think people would have understood what it was actually trying to do.
Well, I think so. That is one thing I think definitely hurt it, was the fact that I think Superman had been recent enough that people may have understood what he was going for, but it had been long enough ago that they didn't really care what he going for.
That is also very fair.
You know, I think, it was by the time Meteor Man came along, the concept of superheroes had more firmly moved into the Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns type of gritty, dour,
grim, dark.
I hate everything. Like,
oh,
you know.
Oh my god.
Because, I think it was not long after this, wasn't it, that they did The Crow?
If not after, then during or slightly before. Also, like, this is the era of, like, going into the shadow.
Right.
Bit later is the Phantom, as well, I think, around this. Like, the Rocketeer might be the brightest of them all, and half of that, like, takes place at night and is dealing with Nazis.
Right. The Crow was 1994, so it would have been in production when Meteor Man came out. And so, like I said, I think one thing that definitely hurt it was the fact that the culture surrounding superheroes had moved on. Which is a pity. That's not to say that this movie would have been perfect, even disregarding that fact, because, you know, a lot of it is not great.
I approached it from first of all, to be really clear, I'm the one who brought this issue / movie to the list here, because I, as a kid, had a copy of the comic book adaptation of this movie, which we will get into. So I have absolute nostalgia for this property, and I know that I had seen the movie years and years and years ago, but like had long forgotten all of it. And I was just so happy and impressed with what I did see, because like the production level for what was available was pretty damn good.
Well, they had Industrial Light and Magic doing the special effects.
Yeah, and it's not only like the special effect, it's like little physical touches, like into the wherever he touches like a car, there's a really good press in there, and it's you know, like a handprint. It's not like someone hit it with a hammer and went, there, it's done or something. No, they like they put a lot of effort into like overselling so much of this, and his outfit is ridiculous, but also kind of ahead of its time, but also really behind its time. And you know, this is what happens when someone who hasn't read comic books since they were young writes and produces a comic book movie. And it has a bunch of cliches, and it's commenting on things that it didn't, like, are part of, like, larger discussions within comicdom, but it didn't even know. Like, it's just doing its own thing. And
right.
That seems to be how he does things. Like, this film opens with a Michael Jackson song at the height of his fame. And he got that apparently, like, free by calling Michael Jackson. And
well, yeah,
he just called. How did he get this amazing cast? He called them. He knew that they were great actors, and so he called them. How did he get this movie produced? He just kept calling people, and eventually Alan Ladd went, "This is fantastic. Yes, this will be the next Star Wars." And I presume the one thing I couldn't find any details on is how the fuck he got not only a comic book adaptation of the movie, but a 6-issue continuing miniseries after it by Marvel. I have no idea, but I presume the answer is he just called him.
Probably.
This man's balls.
Like, hey, it's Robert Townsend. Want to do a comic? And they were just like, yeah.
Okay.
Holy
shit! Robert Townsend's on the phone and he wants to do a comic book. What? Why would he want to do a? No, wait, no, don't ask. Give him money. Give him money.
The thing about it is, like, I'm curious. There's some stuff in this movie that I'm curious about because it's stuff that I am not going to touch with a 10-foot pole because I am not the person to do that.
Yeah.
But like the stuff where he makes peace between the gangs and the police and stuff like that. I was watching that. I was kind of like,
that was fascinating.
The elephant in the room, though.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, and such an elephant.
Bill Cosby is in the cast. And here is the thing. Bill Cosby plays a man. It's never really expressly stated. I believe he is unhoused and squatting in a basement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. In the comic books, it's a little more overt that he is homeless.
Because by and large, he's just like hanging out in an alley. When Robert Townsend is hit by the meteor and he finds and he grabs a fragment of it.
One moment to quickly digress away from the horror of Bill Cosby into the horror of that practical effect shot of the meteor going into his chest. That was pretty damn well done.
Yeah.
That is not how I pictured it happening based on what happens in the comic.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
It's a lot. The thing is, you see him in his home.
Mm-hmm.
Where he is using his telekinesis from the meteor, Bill Cosby, that is, not Robert Townsend, is using his telekinesis to make himself a cup of coffee while creeping on the woman who lives in the apartment above him, using his X-ray vision to look through the floor and through her clothes. Which at the time would have been Bill Cosby playing against type. Ha ha ha. He's a dirty perv. But now.
Oh.
So
there definitely would have been people like even involved in the production of this who probably knew that.
Right.
And like you're sitting there watching it and being like, yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. Because it's like at the time, most of us. Just random people would not have known about that. We would have known Bill Cosby from his comedy, from the Cosby Show, things like that. Robert Townsend and a lot of the people involved with, you know, the production of this may have been aware of the stuff. And, you know, don't get me wrong. Like, if I were making a superhero movie and I had a chance back in, you know, 2007 to put Louis C.K. in my superhero movie.
Yeah, or have it directed by Joss Whedon.
Or something like that. I'd be like, for sure. But here again, I'm not plugged into the entertainment industry and would not, you know, I would not have had the knowledge necessary to be like, this is not going to age well. This is going to be really, really bad.
And my hope is he had no idea for some reason. I don't know how that's possible. God damn it, Bill Cosby. Why do you gotta ruin everything? Like, his part is so small. You could cut around him.
Yeah.
You can. There is a cut of this film where there's just no Bill Cosby. Damn it.
But anyway.
So close. So anyways.
The comic, it began with a one-shot, which was a straight adaptation of the movie. And that was written by Dwight Coy, penciled by Robert Walker, inked by John Holdridge, colored by Gina Going, lettered by Steve Ditko, and edited... Yeah. It was edited by Steve Ditko and edited by lettered by Steve Ditko, sorry, and edited by Fabian Nicieza.
Meteor Man, a Steve Ditko comic.
What I will say about the adaptation is I do not think it's a good adaptation. Large swaths of the movie are cut. But at the same time, not well, in as much as the whole talking to dogs thing doesn't really come up other than one scene where his dog is talking to him. And the comic just doesn't really address it. He never talks to the dog again or anything
it's
that.
It's more just like a passing. I always assumed, you know, until I saw it, that it was like, that was just him joking. Like, oh, maybe I can, what's next or something like that. And right. Yeah, there's entire sequences that don't occur. In the
They don't have the thing where his dad gets beaten up.
I think it happens like just barely off panel and they mention it and it's gone in a moment.
Yeah.
His the costume montage is truncated. The party for him, is completely changed. The only person who is recognizable in this is, Robert Townsend himself. 4 years, I assumed that James Earl Jones surely played his father. You know who I knew? James Earl Jones.
Right.
Who's old? James Earl Jones. So you end up watching the movie and you're like, I have to completely rethink every single character as they were drawn.
Yeah.
Because I get it. You didn't have the image rights to anyone else.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And there's a lot. None of the stuff about uniting the gangs is in here. Not only the part where he does it, but then at the end, once he's defeated Simon Kane and Mr. Byers shows up in the film with his army of thugs. And then the Crips and Bloods are just like, nope, and chase him off. None of that part's in the adaptation at all.
none of it.
There are none of the stuff with Stacy, which is weird because Stacy gets brought up in the sequel, in the in the mini series. Stacy dumping him again is a plot point in passing, but she's not in the adaptation at all. Malik is not in there, the Sinbad character, none of that. You know, just parts of it make sense, but then also, like, one of the great gags in the movie is James Earl Jones at the beginning of the movie trying on toupees, and he decides to go for something young. So the rest of the movie, he is wearing a toupee that gives him a high top fade and hitting on young women.
And like that is absolutely one of the reasons why I never in my life assumed that that was played by James Earl Jones, because it's like, I'm sorry. Excuse me, what? Like, yes, that makes sense. That is visually funny. That is off character. Well done. Smart, smart. On the comic page, I assumed that that character was maybe like 35. Like, not.
Well, and
not James Earl Jones.
The initial scene where he's trying on toupees is there, but then it's not in the rest of the adaptation. There's nothing. The running gag of him having the high top isn't in it, and it's just like, so then why have the scene where he's trying on? You've set up the joke and then cut the joke.
Yeah.
So,
and it's one of those odd things of like, you know, for years I, you know, like thought, oh, you know, this is a fun comic adaptation. It's fun. It's whatever. But yeah, it really does strip so much away. It can be difficult to adapt a movie, especially like, you know, you're trying to make sure that all the scenes fit, everything works as it should, like in a comic as opposed to a film.
Right.
And especially with this, where they had like, they clearly had gotten the rights to like certain characters, but not necessarily like considered using others. So as you said, Frank Gorshin's just fucking ejected. Like, there's this entire global mafia specter thing that he runs. Yeah. And that just gets like thrown out. It's kind of referenced a few times, but you don't get the grand finale where Frank Gorshin is attempting to eat half of the set with what little time he has left on screen. I mean, he goes full Frank Gorshin a few times there.
Yeah.
Ooh, well, very good.
Like, and a lot of the stuff about the Golden Lords, I like the Golden Lords.
Oh, I love them.
They have the baby lords that are little kids that they make dress like them, and like have the gold, the blonde hair, which undermines the whole point of having children in your criminal organization. The point of having kids do your nefarious shit is that the cops won't notice them. Yeah. If you are a drug lord who's just like, I have an army of kids that I have made dress like me in a very specific and identifiable way, then the cops know to stop those children and search their lunch boxes.
And love so, money.
And so I love the idea of it, because the you know, it's just, Simon is such a raging like narcissist.
Yeah,
that he's just like, yes, I will make all the little children look like me. And that's great, but like that's gone. And you know, and like I said, you know, it's I've read a lot of comic book adaptations of movies over the years. I've read a lot of things like this that were a lot more successful. And yes, there are cuts that have to be made, but in the end, you are still given an overall idea of the main beats of the movie. And that is not the case here. I read the comic first before watching the movie, and I was blown away by how much I had missed by doing that. But, you know, because I was sitting there and I'm like, wow, okay, all right, that's sure. But
it's
then
pretty
I,
by the numbers, yeah.
But then I watched the movie and I'm like, oh, they cut a lot of shit from this. Too much. They cut too much, not just major beats of the film, but also, like I said, a lot of the jokes that sort of mark it out as a Robert Townsend story, you know, got cut. And it's just like, so then what about this is going to make me want to see the movie? What about the, if this is meant to promote the film, it doesn't. And if this is meant to bank on the film, then it's kind of going to backfire, especially with then doing the miniseries, because if I were to see the movie and be like, oh, they made a comic, and go by the comic, I'd be so disappointed that there's no way I'm going to pay them for more. So I don't really know, like, when it's all said and done, I don't know that it accomplishes either possible goal.
Which is funny, because as like, you know, as someone who read it as a kid, like target demographic right down the barrel in terms of like, you know, Marvel Comics in the early 90s, you know, I was 7. Money, sure, whatever, I'll go see the movie. The only reason I didn't is it bombed so hard it wasn't actually in theaters when I purchased the comic. And to be clear, gentle listener, this was not purchased in a comic book store. This was purchased off a spinner rack at a magazine kiosk. Mm-hmm. So how long was it there? Who knows?
Yeah.
Did I buy it in 1993 or 1994? I don't fucking have any clue. Was there any chance I was ever going to find the resulting miniseries at that spinner rack? Ha! You don't know how spinner racks in magazine kiosks work, do you?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't count on shit.
Nothing. So I personally did enjoy it, and it did hit exactly right for me. But looking back, I can see all of its many flaws as a comic. And it's like, oh, damn it, that's depressing. It almost ruined it. But
well, so let me ask you a question. It made you want to go out and see the movie. And sure, the movie was then not in theaters anymore. Did you ever go out and rent it? Did you ever, like...
Years and years later, it became very difficult to find. The local movie place near me, this was before the days of Blockbuster had reached out here. There was a legendary movie rental place called Video Difference, and Video Difference would have pretty much anything. Like, they prided themselves on having a massive collection, and that includes like every comedy, art films, documentaries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And for the fucking life of me, they never had Meteor Man. And it took until I think I found it in like Yeah, it must have been like haunting a bargain bin of a Blockbuster or something that I finally found a copy of it on VHS, and I watched it a few times way back when, and then I think just lost it or something. Mm-hmm. So I did see it, but like not until I was far past the age of interest into it and well into the snide teens of like, ew, why do I care about this? And now I'm like 36 and yeah, I fucking care about this.
Well, you know, I remember the ads in all of the comics for Meteor Man, mm-hmm. for the movie itself. And I remember I was unaware of the comic back in the day. I just remember seeing the ads for the movie and being like, oh, it's a superhero movie. I will have to see that. And then I never did. So mm-hmm. I don't know. So then they did a mini series, and the mini series had the same creative team, though it added inkers Mickey Ritter, Tim Toy, Keith Aiken, and Pam Eklund, and colorist Joel Rogers. The rest of the creative team was the same. This is where things get interesting, because the end of the movie ends with him being depowered.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, oh, well, a bigger chunk of the meteor landed in Arizona. Meh. Is that in the movie? Shit, it's that all is, blurring
it,
together.
It was originally cut. It was shot but cut. In which they have the discussion about like the sidekick name, and then you see the image of the like the nerd scientist standing next to the big fucking boulder.
Right. Well, so in the adaptation of it, they did. In the movie, they did not. But then. The miniseries proceeds to introduce, because in the first issue, you see guardsmen. You see guardsmen from like the super villain prisons in the Marvel Universe, and you're just like, huh. Okay, and then issue 2 has fucking Spider-Man in it. And
yeah.
Then
yeah,
Night Thrasher.
Just hi, Spider-Man.
There's yeah.
Spider-Man.
And the thing about it is, so a lot of comics did this. The first Transformers miniseries had Spider-Man in it. You know, and things like that. But generally speaking, those are treated as though it's like, yeah, that's the Marvel Universe, but that's a different Marvel universe. That's a side universe that is not the 616 continuity. But if you get on the Marvel Wiki, that places this in the 616 continuity.
Oh, it absolutely does. And Miles Morales has fought Golden Lords.
Has he?
Yep, Robert Townsend fully created what is still technically Marvel-like characters. This is a Marvel movie in many senses. Huh. And he did a pretty surprisingly good job for someone who just, like, out of the blue managed to create, like, their own superhero and, like, a gang with an interesting narcissistic superhero or supervillain leader. Like,
I didn't remember the Golden Lords. Huh.
No, like, what was it? Oh, I can't remember what issue it was. But yeah, no, the Golden Lords, technically, like, I have no idea their current status. But yeah, they exist in Marvel, and all of this occurred in the 616. So theoretically, Meteor Man is out there somewhere in the Multiverse of Madness.
Why not? But the the overall storyline of the comic.
So early 90s Marvel.
It is. It is.
You could just take this plot and like change the names and just be like, no, it's an X-Men comic now.
Fuck every it. Everything about this is 90s Marvel. From from the appearance of Night Thrasher to just the character designs to,
you don't like mullets?
to the maybe unintentional homoeroticism of the Night Thrasher cover, because I'm sorry, you have a cover wherein Night Thrasher is on top of Meteor Man choking him, and the trade dress has the title Night Moves. I'm sorry. Look. I will freely admit I get older, but I never really grow up. So I will freely admit that this is purely a me thing, but I'm sorry. Good for them. Yeah.
I'm happy for them.
I am,
and so early in the 90s, like, well, Ellen would have never.
Well, it really is. It's nice that two black men can come together like that. But anyway, the upshot of all of this, the overall point in this is, We've had his origin, and he suffered, but in this miniseries, we are dialing it up, and it is really putting him through the ringer. Simon Kane comes back, and he seemingly kills him, which then sends him spiraling.
That'll happen.
Well, you know, he straight up seems to atomize him, and he is broken up about this. And, yes, Simon is a sociopath, but still he has taken a life. And so he spirals until he winds up meeting Spider-Man, and Spider-Man, you know, gives him the talk. And he's just like, well, gee, thanks, Spider-Man, bye. And the Night Thrasher shows up. They team up to take these guys down. Simon Kane comes back, and Meteor Man actually starts to reach him. He starts to say, like, you know, you have all of this power. You can change the world for the better. Like, you don't have to be this way.
Which and, apparently is from an earlier draft by Robert Townsend of the movie, where it ends with. So the whole, like, coming together message of the film, like with bringing the Crips and the Bloods together and then uniting the Crips and the Bloods with the cops, and the community coming together to stand up on behalf of Meteor Man, and like even earlier in the film with that delightful interaction in which he gets in trouble with the principal and some parents of a student because he told the kid not to fight people, and the parents are like, no, you beat the fucking shit out of anyone. And it's like, oh god, 1993, I have conflicting emotions about the messages you used to send. but yeah, it would have ended with him doing the same thing, like following through in the theme and message with the Golden Lords and reaching out to Simon. And that's how it would have ended. The Golden
Which would
Lords
have been a
would
lot
have...
more thematically yeah. appropriate.
It, Absolutely.
It would have been wonderful. I'd have, that would have made it one of my favorite movies. Because, okay. This is a frustration of mine. in that in movies and television shows, especially superhero media, we are at a point now where we want compelling villains.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want villains who are just like, I'm evil for the sake of evil.
No.
They have to have some motivation. You know, everyone is the hero of their own story and yada, yada, yada. And so what we wind up with is villains with relatable goals, relatable motivations, but they kill people so you can safely ignore anything they do.
Mm-hmm.
Killmonger makes a lot of great points, but he kills people indiscriminately, so fuck him. The Flag Smashers make a lot of really good points, but they blow people up indiscriminately, so it's safe to ignore everything they say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we get a lot of the time. And that's one of the reasons that something like Everything Everywhere All at Once is so refreshing, is mm-hmm. because, not to get, I'm not going to spoil anything. If you've not seen it, go fucking see it. It's amazing. Go see it. For fuck's sake, go see it. But it does that. It treats its characters empathetically. Even the villain is treated empathetically. And in the end, there's catharsis for everybody.
Not only catharsis for the characters you're looking at, but like multiversal catharsis.
Right.
A lot of different universes become better. You should definitely see Everything Everywhere All at Once. For that reason, and of course, the dildo fight as well.
well, there's a lot of, yeah. But to have gotten a movie that did that in 1993 would have mm-hmm. been amazing, where you know, the hero actually reaches out to the villain and they come to an understanding, and the villain is given something that they were missing, and stuff like that would have been amazing. Unfortunately, they do this with Simon Kane in the comic and then he immediately dies.
Which is a shame, because like you can even see the stepping stones there. Like, what kind of a gangster keeps little children around that he protects and like makes sure are like they're clothed, they've got tons of cash. When the karate guy on his team gets thrown into a bus, he picks him up and goes, "Are you okay?"
Yeah.
He's not like he's a bad guy, but not bad guy. You know, like he is someone that absolutely is looking for a sense of community and has created one right. around himself and his own ego and image.
Well,
yes.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, the potential was there. And I suspect that that's like leftover potential of that ending. And we don't even kind of get it in the same sense of like, you know, like community support and mutual support and stuff. It's more the Marvel Comics sense of like, no, now that I've turned good, I'm inflicted by pathos. I'm going to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, fuck.
There are a lot of characters in this The villain in this mini series, he's kind of interesting in that.
I so feel like he got pulled from something else.
Well, it's interesting because he is Southeast Asian. I don't know if they ever actually, was it Vietnamese?
I think it's implied heavily at that point, but like, I can't recall a specific. Yeah.
His name is Solomon Min.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication in all of this is that following the Vietnam War, he was left an orphan and wound up sold into sexual slavery. And then he managed, because he has powers, I don't think we ever get an explanation for his powers, but he has the ability to split into three versions of himself, all of whom are super strong and blah blah, you know, the standard powers.
Yeah, your base set.
But he manages to lift himself out of that and become a fixer for this guy Armand Sky, who is he supposed to be an alien?
I wasn't sure at all. That's where like it bleeds into. I don't even consider these six issues. Like by the time I got to the end of it, I didn't consider these six issues to be part of this movie whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's so obviously like parts of other projects, or maybe an entirely different project with just like nouns changed. Because yes, I'm going to say yes. He's either an alien or a mutant. But, like there's the potential of being like, oh, from the race that the meteor was part of a planet of. Like you could have done something with that.
Well, there were a lot of things going on with Armand Sky that felt like they were leading to something, and then they just kind of didn't.
Yeah, then they realize, oh shit, no, this ends at issue six. Oh no. I presume that they hoped that this would catch on and it would become an ongoing.
Right.
And maybe they were just kind of like layering in a little bit. Like, okay, and if it happens, then come issue nine, we're going to find out who Armand Sky is. Ooh, and then issue nine never happened.
But he winds up going to prison, and his company ends up having to donate a bunch of money to the neighborhood to avoid bad PR. And you're just kind of like, oh, okay. The thing that, you know, it really does, it feels much like when I was in the theater watching I Am Legend. I had never read the novella. And mm-hmm. So.
Although, had you seen The Omega Man?
I had not.
Okay.
I had no, basis for anything prior to going into I Am Legend. And so it bugged the shit out of me that, that they were setting up all of this stuff about, ooh, the vampires are smarter than they first appeared, and then the movie's just like, nah, fuck it, we just blow them up, it's fine. Yeah. And I'm just like, what? And I then read about it, and I'm like, oh, that is something I wasn't imagining. That okay, that's what this feels like. That's what Armand Sky and a lot of this crap feels like. He is out here giving people powers because we have a bunch of villains like Malefactor and Ghost Strike and super racist Thor and and another woman. I don't remember her name, but they all get pieced out over the course of things. I guess my one thing that really bothers me is, since the movie is set in a world where superheroes aren't a thing,
mm-hmm.
setting the follow-up miniseries squarely in the Marvel universe kind of makes the events of the first adaptation really fucking weird, because they're just like, oh my god, you have superpowers? And it's just like, this is the Marvel universe. Everything gives you superpowers. Being out in the sun too long gives you superpowers. Not getting enough sun gives you superpowers. Getting just the right amount of sun gives you superpowers. Nobody should be this surprised by anything. Like, somebody should just be like, oh, are you a mutant? And it'll just be like, no, there was a meteor. And they're like, oh, okay, sure. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Meteor Man. All right.
Yeah. Why not? And to that note, if I were a mutant in the Marvel Universe, especially in the early 90s, and someone asked, are you a mutant? I'd be like, nope! Meteor powers! Meteor hit me.
Yeah, for sure. I, you know, like, there, as things have gone through and it's been like, uh-oh, like, yeah, I can totally understand why people would just be like, nope, not a mutant. No mutants here. Yep. Mm. No,
don't
sir.
Know what are you talking about? No, I'm cis. What are you talking about?
Yeah, no, it's, I don't know. It ain't great. It's an interesting,
you can see how it fails.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you can see how you can see how the film unfortunately failed. You can see how the single comic adaptation failed, and you can see how the follow-up 6-issue miniseries failed. And it's like, you know, looking at it from the perspective of how this kind of thing would occur now, it's like, oh my god, a multi-level campaign, like marketing campaign and promotional scheme, completely fell apart. That must be worth so many tens of millions of dollars. And it's like, ultimately, this happened because, as discussed, Robert Townsend felt like it and called some people. Yeah, some money was missed in this, but he doesn't, yeah, it didn't affect him.
Yeah. What I will say, I do respect Robert Townsend for making a movie with a predominantly black cast, mm-hmm. at a time when the studio's narrative would be, that's not going to sell.
Oh, in his interview with Shondaland.com, he literally says that one of the more common responses he got from studios was black audiences and black superhero audiences. No, those things don't exist.
Right.
We're not giving you money.
Well, and to not even, because I think what ultimately surprised me was the fact that the studios did not force him to put at least one, like, hugely bankable white star into the movie. Because, like,
I mean, wait a minute. There is one hugely bankable, technically on paper, white star in this movie.
I don't want to talk about Wallace Shawn.
Wallace Shawn! Inconceivable.
I got nothing but love for Wallace Shawn, but I don't think the star of My Dinner with Andre was necessarily going to be the draw that the studio was hoping for.
I don't think you understood what late 1993 felt like or felt about Wallace Shawn. It was Shawnamania, I tell you. For like a good solid 3 weeks there. that this fell outside of.
Sure, why not? But no, I mean, I respect committing to telling a black story with black actors wherein the studio is not able to force you to have some kind of white savior narrative, to have a George Clooney or a Bruce Willis or, you know, whoever, as, you know, like
to have a whoever the I can't believe I've completely spaced on his name, but the quote unquote main character of Big Trouble in Little China.
Kurt Russell. Yeah.
No, not yeah, but his like his character.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, so, you know, like sure he's the main character, but no, he's not the main character.
No.
He's the comic relief. But yeah, not even that. And that's great. That's wow, yeah. you don't get to see that much. When Wallace Shawn is the only white guy in a film.
Well, and Frank Gorshin, of course. But
and Frank Gorshin. Well, I mean, the big bad guy pulling all the strings behind all crime had to have been a white guy.
Well, yeah.
Because it is a white guy.
Naturally. But yeah, I
love how he shows up in a Rolls and everyone else is like sports cars and beaten down shit. It's just, oh, there's the Rolls.
Well,
that's Frank Gorshin.
I will say I do like that they have the rant. There's not just like it's astounding. It's not just like really nice car. There it is, a full blown like old school Rolls. It is mm-hmm. it is like fucking Daddy Warbucks Rolls rolling up to kill Meteor Man. And it's just like, oh my God, it's a full blown gangster. Holy shit. But yeah, I mean, I respect a lot of what Robert Townsend did here. Did it work out? Obviously not. You know, it cost $20 million and made $8 million. There was no chance of there being a sequel. you know.
I'm happy, frankly, that it ate and destroyed $12 million, because I got $12 million worth of happiness out of it, from my perspective anyway.
Well, that's
over
good.
Over the years.
That's good. Yeah. Go watch Hollywood Shuffle. Go watch The Five Heartbeats.
And if you're interested in seeing where this eventually led to, go watch the episodes of Black Lightning, the CW Black Lightning that Robert Townsend appeared in and directed.
Yeah.
Because of this.
Yeah.
Like there is an impact. There is an influence on like on-screen black superheroes that Robert Townsend has been like more or less ignored. And he deserves to stand there as someone who helped influence all of these characters that you now just take for granted.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is genuinely Robert Townsend deserves a bigger career than he has had the last. I mean, he's working, but
and he's respected, but it's like, oh, fuck you. You're a performer's performer, a director's director, which just means that the audience doesn't know who the fuck you are.
But I mean,
which is a fucking shame.
The dude directed Eddie Murphy Raw. Like,
yeah, people know his work.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
So Robert Townsend deserves way more than he has gotten is the thrust of all of this. The comic series, not great. Robert Townsend,
not good enough.
Fucking amazing. Yeah. Go check out his work if you're not familiar with him. Hollywood Shuffle is great. The Five Heartbeats. If you're white, you've probably not heard of The Five Heartbeats. If you're black, you probably know it. But you know, yeah, he's great. I don't know.
He he's great, and unfortunately, none of these properties, none of these three things actually live up to what he has otherwise done, and it's just a goddamn shame that audiences didn't show up for it the first time, because I would have liked to see this spiral off into endless sequels.
And then, then of course, the gritty reboot after gritty reboot, you know, that would have been amazing. Get Zack Snyder's Meteor Man.
Oh, my fucking God.
If there is one person that could handle the first mainstream black superhero, it's Zack Snyder.
I feel pain inside of me, deep inside of me. Only pain and suffering. Well, if you want to suffer some more with us, shit, like, share, and subscribe, contact us. We have an email, yeah?
Yeah, it is multiversalmarketing@gmail.com. send us an email. And
for
then,
sure, India do.
Join us next time. We will be talking about the Axe body spray superhero team, the Freshmen.
Fuck.
Because it works on multiple levels. You see, on the one hand, they are teenagers. On the other hand, they reek of Axe body spray. So they are literally fresh men.
It's like it has two intentions there. There's a double, sure. Whatever you want to, yeah. I'm sure someone will come up with a term for that.
There are layers of meaning here.
There's at least two, yeah.
We're going to peel this motherfucker like an onion, let me tell you.
It's going to stick to high heaven.
Bye.
Bye.